We put our safety aside and we forget that it is a basic fundamental human need to feel safe, to be able to conceive and carry a child. Like, we forget about this. How many times have you heard of people who've been going through fertility processes? Again, doesn't matter whether they're cisgendered or whether and straight or whether they're part of the queer community. Been doing it for years. Now, heterosexuals, all of a sudden, they stop going to fertility. We're going to take a break. We're going to take some time. We're just going to, and then something happens that they end up becoming pregnant during that time because some of the stress is left. I recognize that's not all of it. And so any listeners who say, you know, please don't come for me when I say this, I recognize that that's not the only piece, but for some people, it is a big piece. And so that's just a reminder that we have to find the space that honors us.
Welcome to Philippa Squared, Parenting by Design, the podcast that dives deep into the heart of thriving through pregnancy, birth, and beyond. If you aspire towards exceptional parenthood and are looking to navigate the joys and challenges of raising children in our fast-paced world, you've found your tribe. I'm Philippa Scott and
I'm Philippa Cox. Together we're Philippa Squared, unpacking the real talk on modern parenting, peeling back the layers of its complexity from pregnancy and birth to the adventures beyond. This podcast is your guide to unraveling the nuances of parenting in today's world.
And we're keeping it real, sharing stories and having conversations with insightful guests, giving you clarity and direction on your parenting journey.
This is where your adventure begins, transforming the challenge into a journey of wonder and joy, where you discover ways to craft your own parenthood map, not just follow the one handed down to you.
So settle in, get comfy, and let's laugh, learn, and grow into the parent you aspire to be. Welcome to Philippa Squared, Parenting by Design.
Hello and welcome to Philippa Squared, Parenting by Design. I'm Philippa Scott and I'm joined once again by my beautiful co-host, Pippa Cox. Hi, Pippa.
Hello, Philippa.
How are you on this wet and windy?
Oh, fabulous, as always. Now, I believe we have a really special guest today.
We do. We have the beautiful Sam Leeson. So, Sam, hi, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
They will have already listened to the intro, but please tell us about yourself and how you got into the work that you do.
I am a 50-something-year-old woman who is in my second marriage. I have grown adult children that I birthed in their mid-20s. I give birth to boys. I like to say my uterus only carries boys. My wife carries girls. So I got a girl because I married my wife who had a daughter. And yes, I'm married to the love of my life. I've been a birth worker for over 25 years, childbirth educator. These days, I'm primarily a queer family planning expert as well as a parenting coach. And I got into the work in general because I had a really crappy birth experience with my first child and felt like I didn't have the opportunity to make the decisions that I wanted to make or the information to be able to feel like I was in a decision-making position through the pregnancy, labor, and birth of my first child. Now, bear in mind, this was over 25 years ago, so things were different, but as much as they were different, they're still very much the same in a lot of respects. So that's sort of what pushed me into this realm of helping people make the best informed decisions they can possibly make to have the best experience they can possibly have.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I feel that.
Yeah. And what exactly does that look like for you in what you're doing in the queer space?
Now what it means is really spending a lot of time. I host a podcast myself called Becoming Baby Ready, where I speak with queer professionals who work alongside those who are looking to start or grow their family through parenthood. I also speak with queer parents about their journey, including things like how much it cost, where they felt like they were made to feel safe, where they were made to feel othered, how they feel that the journey could be easier for themselves or people coming behind them afterwards. So that's a huge part of what I do. And then I also do that kind of activity in person. So I host queer family planning events where I have speakers come and talk to people, because it's easy for me to do a podcast and ask the questions I want to ask, but my uterus is done and dusted. I'm not planning on reigniting anything in there anytime soon. So I ask the questions that I think to ask, and I have the conversation that I think to have, but I'm not the one that's in the process of trying to decide how to start my family, how to grow my family, where do I get the answers that I need. So the in-person things are so exciting, because people come and they get to sit and they listen to someone's story and they get to ask the questions, and they all, I've been gifted with the opportunity to have people always leave and say to me, that was what I needed. I didn't know I needed this, but I know I had questions and this was perfect. So thank you. So I'm pretty excited about that.
That's fabulous.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. So what are the main questions that people are asking in this space? How is it different?
In some cases, it's very different. In other cases, it's not. So some of the questions that I get asked are, how much is it going to cost? So I always talk very candidly about the reality that queer families are not inexpensive. We intentionally create our families, but always recognize we're going to need reproductive assistance in some fashion. And so we talk realistically about costs. We talk about where to go to get the support that you need in a safe environment, because everybody puts up a rainbow flag, especially during the month of June. There's rainbows everywhere. And everybody thinks, well, if I just put the flag there, then they'll know that they can come here. But when you walk into an appointment and, you know, you're two people with uteruses and the one who wants to get pregnant is sitting there with their partner, and the partner gets asked if they're a friend or a family member, it's just, you know, it's, you're constantly outing yourself and things like that. So where can people go that when I fill up my intake form and it says, this is who I am and this is who my partner is and this is the dynamics of our relationship, that's actually read? I mean, how often have you been to a doctor's appointment and you filled out all the paperwork and then they ask you the questions that are on the paper in front of them without having read it? And so just little things like that that make the journey so much easier and make them feel that much more confident. Where do they go to talk to people about, you know, I don't know in Australia if it is the law that you have to, if you are using the gametes of another person, whether you're a cisgendered heterosexual couple, or you're a same-sex couple or someone who's part of the 2SLGBTQIA+ community, if you're using the gametes of another person to create your family, then you have to go for what's called implications counseling. And your fertility clinic needs to know you've done this before you can move forward. And so little things like that, where can I go to have implications counseling with someone who is also same-sex so they understand it from that lens? So there's all kinds of little questions like that come up frequently, but it comes up for everybody. I mean, there's lots of couples who are cisgendered heterosexual, but who aren't white or who don't practice traditional Christian religions and things like that, but they still need help to create their families. And so if I come in a hijab and I'm going to have an appointment, is it guaranteed that the person I'm going to see is going to be someone with a uterus? Because I need that. I need to know that. So those kinds of questions come up too. It's not just queer folk that have these conscious decision-making processes that they have to go through in order to be able to get the support that they feel safest with.
There's a lot of talk around, you know, well, there's a lot of trauma around any sort of assisted fertility. I know in Australia there's a sense of shame that comes with all of that, mm-hmm. With the need to, or and knowing that they couldn't fall pregnant on their own. So there's a huge trauma mm-hmm. journey, and even when you can, you know, when you're ready to have a child, that journey of every month not getting that positive test can be mm-hmm. a really traumatic and stressful time. So add to what is already a stressful emotive time, these layers of extra needs and extra considerations, and you are opening up a huge world of potential for lots of different traumas and lots of different triggering events that can make it even harder. I like, you know, you talk about these conscious decisions that we need to make, and I think often as, you know, and as a cis woman in a heterosexual relationship, I know that in the beginning of our journey, yes, we consciously conceived each of our children. We made a decision that we were having this baby and then this baby and then this baby and then this baby all the way through to number four. It took me longer to convince Trevor to have baby three and four, so there's a bit of a longer gap. But we did consciously intend to have each of those children, although he does tell me he was just having sex. But you don't drive half an hour home from work to just have sex, although maybe if you're a man you do, I don't know. Anyway, we had to, you know, we consciously made those decisions, but things that we didn't consciously think about was, you know, the implications of, you know, potential trauma. There was so many things that we didn't think about. We didn't talk about our value systems as parents. We didn't talk about, you know, styles of parenting. There's all sorts of decisions that we made unconsciously. And I think there's value in actually bringing a lot of this stuff and being baby ready, consciously thinking about what do I need to do to be ready to be a parent, because it's not just mm-hmm. about having a baby, right? That's the, no matter how you look at it, no matter how it happens, that's the easy bit. Getting to have a baby is the easy part of being a parent, because the next 18 to 25 mm-hmm. years is actually where, you know, where the rest of the work's going to happen. But if we can start it out right, it makes a huge impact.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
People, what were you going to say?
And you're right. Those are the conversations you want to start with from the very beginning before you even create the embryo or plan, you know, your fertility cycling and that kind of thing. You want to have some kind of a plan in place about what does the future actually look like.
Yeah. And also with IVF, it is a massive roller coaster with assisted mm-hmm. delivery, isn't it? It is mm-hmm. massive. And I take my hat off to any couple and any individual that go through that process, because mm-hmm. it's massive farming eggs and with all the huge hormonal injections you have to do, and every month, am I not? It is massive, and I'm getting goosebumps mm-hmm. just thinking about it. And I do take my hat off to the strength that women and men have to go by mm-hmm. when they go through that process. One thing I just wanted to ask you, Sam, is that do you also help males, same-sex males?
Mm-hmm. I do.
And I would love to unpack that with you, because it is something that now that the community is coming together and it's becoming mainstream, that mm-hmm. now there's less pressure and less judgment on men. And I would just love you to unpack that and see how men are approaching it and what obstacles they're coming by and how they're rectifying it.
Unfortunately, I think there will always be, I want to say that it's not the case, but I think there will always be bigotry that falls out. And so it can be something that, you know, I was just talking to a couple last week and we were having a consultation, and they were talking about how excited they are about their journey and how they've been, you know, posting about it online because that's the path that they're taking, and they want to get feedback from other people. They want to hear other people's stories and all of the things and the negative comments that get made. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, people reach out to me to learn about what some of their options are. So they are a same-sex male couple or a man by himself who wants to hire a surrogate, you know, and then they look at what their options are. Do we want to do a public adoption? Do we want to do a private adoption? Do we want to do a surrogacy? What are the financial pieces for all of that? And where do I find resources for that? And then we do classes together, but they're not traditional prenatal classes in lots of cases, because it's often that the surrogate has already birthed, well, in all cases, surrogates have birthed other children before. That's part of the requirements, at least here for surrogacy, is that you need to be able to say that you are able to carry a viable pregnancy to term and that you've done it before. So they don't necessarily need the prenatal classes. And it's most of the time, not always, but most of the time, the intended parents are not in the room at the time of the birth. They are in the hospital when it's happening, or they're in the home when it's happening, but they're not necessarily in the room. So they don't need to know how to physically support and offer words of encouragement and, you know, where to put the ice packs, you know, and how do you put the ice around the neck and all of the double hip squeeze. They don't need any of that. But they do need to know how to care for babies. So perhaps we may not spend as much time talking about the prenatal stuff. Although if their surrogate or their adoptive parent has been to an appointment and has told them what's going on and they have questions about it, they can come to me and ask me questions. You know, if they say that this is happening and this is happening, then what does that mean? And, you know, they're talking about induction at this point, and how will they induce and how long does that take? And so they don't have to bombard their surrogate or their adoptive birthing parent to ask the questions about what all of that means. They can reach out to me and we can go through the process together, and we can talk about how to set their home up for feeding their baby and skin to skin time and all of those really valuable pieces of the puzzle that so often get handed out in antenatal appointments and in prenatal classes and all of these things. And they're little pieces that someone who isn't doing that doesn't get a chance to enjoy or savor. So I get a chance to do that with them.
That's so cool.
That's beautiful.
There's one of the things that I think a lot of parents who go down the IVF track or who have assisted reproduction in some way is they're often deemed as high risk pregnancies, high risk births, even though they just needed help getting pregnant. And it doesn't actually mean that they're high risk in any other way, shape or form, but they're often treated as such. And I think there's a huge shift and a huge need for support for parents who are going through that journey of IVF and or any sort of assisted fertility. This coming back to the knowledge that their body works, or the body works, that, you know, that birth works, even if fertility was a rocky road, you can still have a normal low risk pregnancy. You can birth at home, you can birth, you know, in a birth center or whatever. But you don't have to have, it's not all of a sudden a high-risk pregnancy and high-risk birth. It can be a little higher risk in some instances, and depending on the situation, it can be high risk, but so can any pregnancy. And so really coming back to that learning and, I guess, taking back that control, because we often, or one of the things that I noticed with the IVF parents that I work with, is that they're just railroaded into, you know, having a surgeon as their care provider. They're railroaded into thinking that they are a high risk pregnancy right from the get go. And so they feel like they don't have any options. Do you find that happens a lot where you are too?
it does happen a lot where I am too. And that's a big part of the whole process. It's easier when I'm having conversations with the person who has the uterus and they're asking the questions about what their options are. What questions do I ask of my care team? You know, and they say to me before the conception even occurs, you know, my hope is to birth with midwives. And I can say, great. I don't know, again, about the reality in Australia, but in Ontario, Canada, you pretty much have to call your midwife to get on the wait list the day you pee on the stick because they're so full up. And so I always say, put your name on the list. You can make all the decisions later on, but if your name's not on the list, then that's not, then you're closing that door. And if your hope is to have fewer interventions, if possible, in your birth, if you're hoping to have your baby at home or those kinds of things, and we can have those conversations. Here, it's not automatic that if you receive reproductive assistance, you're automatically not going to be able to have midwifery care because midwives are only legislated as primary care providers for low-risk pregnancies and births, or what is expected to be a low-risk pregnancy and birth. IVF doesn't necessarily automatically put you into that category, IUI, ICI, all of that. And certainly there are some surrogates who still plan to have home births, even though they've conceived with reproductive assistance, if that's their choice. And that's been a conversation I've had on more than one occasion with people who've hired a surrogate, and this is how the surrogate would like to birth. And they're like, well, but we want to know that things are going to go very, very cleanly. So could we just schedule a cesarean section on such and such a date and such a time that I know that that's packaged all put together very neatly in the corner, and not really fully understanding the way that the whole process can unfold and the recovery process, right? And I just was saying this to somebody last week. We live in a world where having a vaginal birth and having a cesarean birth are synonymous with one another, that they roll off the tongue just as easily, which isn't to suggest, and I'm not even sure what the word is I'm trying to say, but I fully have respect for the fact that there are a significant number of people who need to have cesarean births in this world. They live through the process, their baby lives through the process because we have the option to do that safely for people, but it doesn't necessarily need to be the first decision that's made or the first path chosen for many people. And so I like to be able to remind somebody that cesarean births are more invasive surgery than many cardiac surgeries are these days. And so that's, again, not to take away from it, but give it the respect that it deserves. If someone's birthing for you, or if you're birthing and you've had a cesarean birth, you're going to need time to recover. And that's going to make parenting more difficult if you've got the child with you. It's just a reality of healing from surgery. It takes time. And babies are less forgiving about that. They don't really realize that you've just had major surgery that you need to recover from.
No, they don't, do they? They don't know.
I keep showing them in the manual, but they don't read it.
I had my first by Caesar, and it was the hardest experience of my life. Like, the recovery was, and I still, 21 years later, there are still pains in my body that I feel as a result of that surgery. And I had all my other three naturally, including two at home, and it was way easier to care for four children having just had a normal birth than it was to care for one child having had surgery. And it is, mm-hmm. it is huge, and it is not something to be, you know, it is a hard road, and full respect to those women who do that. And, you know, my closest girlfriend did it four times, and, you know, that's a hard road. It is not for the faint of heart. And I think people forget just how hard it is to parent after a C-section. Agreed. It's not easy. And so it should not be our first option for anyone to go through that kind of surgery. It's big.
Yeah, exactly. Because people kind of forget that it was actually invented to save people's lives. And it did save people's lives. Saves one out of every 10 women worldwide.
Yep.
And people forget that.
I'm glad that the option is there. If people need to have it, then I'm grateful that they that option is there, so that they can live through the experience and they can care, you know, grow, care for their child and parent their child into adulthood, where that option wasn't available however many years ago, right? So I am grateful, but I do become frustrated with the fact that people just sort of, it becomes such an off the cuff kind of thing. And I really, I mean, it's hard as a feminist, as somebody who strongly believes in bodily autonomy. If someone truly wants to do that, this is their body. They should have the right to make the decision if they have all of the information. But how do we provide information in an unbiased fashion so that someone can make a truly informed decision about something?
Yes, because it is a myth, isn't it? Informed decision making is a myth.
It sure
even
is.
The way that we're talking about it, the tone in our voice, our body language, everything, it's an absolute myth. And the best thing that women can do and men can do is to do their own research and provide their own meaning and get their clarification from someone that knows as well, that is an expert in their field, and they can dissect it and answer their questions. And that's how you find the ultimate in informed decision making.
I fully agree. And that includes speaking to someone who is a trauma specialist, because so much of the decision making that we make about our bodies, especially when it comes to something like that, that we become very hard-nosed about, no, I need this, I need to do this, this is how it has to be. First of all, that's almost a surefire way to make sure it doesn't happen the way you wanted it to happen, because as soon as you put something in concrete, then somebody always does something to step in the concrete. But, you know, we need to have somebody to talk through all of this with as well, so that we can process why this decision is so important to me.
Mm-hmm. It comes back to that intuition versus instinct, doesn't it? We did a great podcast on that a while ago. But when we are making that decision based on fear, or that we're sitting in a place of survival, mm-hmm. we're going to make instinctive decisions. But that's not a deep knowing made on love and trust and a foundational belief. And it's not until we remove the fear, remove the trauma, remove those unconscious beliefs, and the things that we've experienced in our life that we hold emotional attachment to, when all of that is dealt with, then we can actually sit in this space and we're not emotionally attached to the outcomes or the ideas that came before, and we're able to sit in that space and go, okay, now what's important to me now? And why is that important to me now? But it's not emotive, and it doesn't carry with it fear and past experiences and so on. We can just show up and make the decision based on what we feel is right for us in that moment. And that's intuitive. And intuition then is the decision that's going to allow us to feel good about that in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, in 50 years' time, because that's what ultimately, that's the test of a good decision, right? We can still feel good about that, or good about the process that we undertook to get to that decision, even if we discover that maybe that decision was wrong, we know that the process that we made or we went through was a good one.
Right.
Yeah. So that's really where it comes to, isn't it? It's intuition instead of instinct, you know, dealing with all that stuff, which affects everyone.
Sure. But it's hard to do, though, when you're looking at labor, though, when you're in a labor process, if you're in it.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, which is why we say, don't we, Pippa, do the work before you get there.
Yes.
You know, do the work before you get there. If you are lucky enough to have found someone who can help you do that work pre, then do the work pre. My favorite clients are the ones who come to me before they even have a baby and say, I want to sort my shit out now, not wait until after I've had the baby or I'm in labor to deal with it. And it's often second, you know, your stories like mine, I got into this work because I had a shitty first birth experience, right? And so I did the work before the second one, but I still didn't deal with all the stuff until, you know, my eldest was 16, you know, but that it's unfortunate that we often have to go the hard road to learn just how important and impactful it is to do that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Pippa mm-hmm. and I are both very, very passionate about doing the work before you have the baby where at all possible.
Oh, yes.
Once you've got that kid, it's like a mirror, right? It's like there's and everything is magnified. You know, everything is magnified. It becomes so much bigger than it was pre-baby. Any issues in your relationship, any issues in your self-confidence, any issues in your understanding even of who you are, or your stuff with your own parents, all of that stuff is going to be magnified. And I imagine that, and I can't speak because it's not my world, but, you know, when you are coming from a queer perspective or you're coming in with all of that other cultural stuff that impacts you on mm-hmm. a day-to-day level because you don't fit the norm or you don't fit the heterosexual cis space, that's going to have even more impact on your parenting, on who you are and any trauma that you've experienced. It's going to be even bigger, right?
For sure. And that's actually the most recent in-person event that I did. I had a trauma expert there to speak because virtually everyone in the queer community has experienced some form of trauma, whether it was coming out to their parents and their parents didn't accept them, whether it was coming out to their peers didn't accept them, whether it was trying to find a job and they were, you know, just there was bias before they even walked in the door because of past experiences that they've put on their resume. It's everywhere all the time. And so then we walk into an environment where we don't know anyone, like a reproductive center. And we ask for support or a surrogacy agency and we ask for assistance in creating our families. And we're very cautious and tentative as we ask for some information and support. And all of that is rooted in the trauma that we've experienced leading up to that moment. And at the end of the day, creating our family is supposed to be the most joyous time in our life. We're supposed to be able to look at that day and say, this is the day that our family was made and it's supposed to be wonderful and exciting. And so if you haven't processed what you've come into the whole process with, then you carry that forward. You know, no parent wants to teach their child about internalized homophobia. They just don't. But it happens.
Mm. Yeah. And for people in this community to actually make that decision, it is such a massive conscious decision.
Mm-hmm.
I think personally, as opposed to a heterosexual couple, because heterosexuality is normalized in our society.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we're entering into a brave new world with the rainbow crowd. And they, like you, like it's a massive, brave, brave new world. And thank goodness it's evolved mm-hmm. in the last 50 years. It's giving me goosebumps the way that it's evolved.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's moved forward well in many places. Right? And that's, you're right. It should give you goosebumps because that's exciting. There are still countries where it's illegal to be queer. And so that's heartbreaking. But at the end of the day, we're hoping that the small inroads being made are constantly making changes. But yes, it's exciting. It is exciting. The future is exciting.
It is. It is. And what's that thing? The future's so bright. I think I need shade.
That's right.
Remember that?
I do remember.
Yeah. So it's a great conversation. Just to wrap up, like, what are some of the key gold nuggets that we can just leave our listeners with that you can just impart about being part of this community and to wanting to form a family?
I think that one of the things that I encourage everyone to do, whether they're cisgendered and heterosexual or they're part of the queer community, when you're having a family and you're creating a library of books to read to your child as they're growing up, make them diverse, make them see and learn about all families, all people, all types of professions, all religions, so that they have the opportunity to learn from infancy that the fact that we are all so different is truly beautiful and it's exciting instead of being something to be afraid of. I think that's one of the first things that I would encourage everyone to do. I think I would also just be conscious in the decisions you're making, whether you're part of the queer community or not. If you're on a reproductive path and you need assistance, ask the questions from the hop about what's going to make you feel safe. And as I said before, take your religion into consideration. It doesn't just have to be your sexuality. It can be your religion. It can be your past experiences with different care providers, feeling like they didn't listen to you. So write the things down that are really important to you and ask at your very first meeting with your new care team, ask them to answer those questions for you so that you can know right off the hop if this is going to feel like a safe space for you through something that is going to make you more vulnerable than anything you've ever been through before. Because all of the testing is invasive. All of the everything that they have to do, all the questions they have to ask, it's going to dig things up for you, that they're going to create emotions. So if it doesn't feel safe from the very beginning, that's okay. There are other places that will feel safe. And I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who have had reproductive assistance over the years, who have said that they went to 3 or 4 different facilities before they found the one that felt like home to them. And so that, like I say, I don't think that that's just for cisgendered heterosexual folks. I think that's for anybody who's having a baby or wanting to create a family or going through the adoption process, or whether it's private or public, you know, find out where you fit in and don't settle for less.
Yeah.
Love this. Because when you're on this journey, you have to feel it, that it's right within you. If you don't feel safe, how on earth are you going to fall pregnant? That's our basic human need.
That's exactly it.
Love it.
We end up putting that aside. We put our safety aside. And we forget that it is a basic fundamental human need to feel safe, to be able to conceive and carry a child. Like, we forget about this. How many times have you heard of people who've been going through fertility processes? Again, doesn't matter whether they're cisgendered or whether and straight or whether they're part of the queer community. They've been doing it for years. Now, heterosexuals, all of a sudden, they stop going to fertility. We're going to take a break. We're going to take some time. And then something happens that they end up becoming pregnant during that time because some of the stress is left. I recognize that's not all of it. And so any listeners who say, you know, please don't come for me when I say this, I recognize that that's not the only piece, but for some people it is a big piece. And so that's just a reminder that we have to find the space that honors us.
Absolutely. That beautiful inner safety and self-care, again, is a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. Honoring ourselves and honoring our needs.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah.
That comes back to worthiness. That comes back to worthiness. And when we understand how worthy we are and that we are worthy, then we get to demand what we need from our care providers. We get to, it's right from knowing that we have the right partner, right? Like, when we know our own worth, we demand that our partner show up and knows our worth and that they're the right person for us. And we We get more out of our care providers. We get more out of the whole world when we understand what we're worthy of, and not in a demanding way, but simply in a way that says, no, I'm actually worth more than that. So I'm moving on until I find somebody who's worthy of me. And if more women thought about their care providers in that way, if more women felt worthy and could look to their care provider and say, is he worthy of me? Is she worthy of me? Or do I, in fact, deserve to be treated better? If we were able to show up in our fertility journey, in our parenting journey in that space, we would all get a lot better care, and we'd actually lift the bar, because the bar is so low, right? The bar is so low in terms of what women expect in terms of their care, or what, you know, women particularly, but you know, for most people, that the bar is so low, and we need to expect more for ourselves. So yeah, and that comes from worthiness. And where does that come from? Doing the work. We say it all the time. Do the work.
Right. There are some common themes, Philippa, that are coming up in all our episodes.
We can't say it enough, though.
No, nope. Yeah, because it makes such a difference.
Sure.
It makes such a difference. It's made such a difference to your life, Philippa, to mine, to yours, Sam, and to all the people that we help. Mm-hmm. Massive.
Absolutely.
Okay. Massive.
Thank you so much, Sam. We will add your information into the show notes so that people know how to get in touch with you and work with you. And yeah, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. So thank you very much. Folks, if you have enjoyed this episode, please follow, please subscribe, please share it around and help us get this message to more people. So thank you again, Sam, and thank you, Pippa.
Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Philippa. Thanks.